What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff. In a legal face-off, hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
It's the first show of February on Legal Faceoff, WGN at WGNradio.com. Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside in studio after quite the Super Bowl. The other day, the Patriots come back and beat the Falcons. We'll talk about much in the legal grab bag. We'll also talk about the threats. Donald Trump threatening to send in feds to Chicago, and then some Illinois workers' compensation reform issues. But we start with SCOTUS. President Trump has made a pick. It's Neil Gorsuch. And to lead it off, we will join Andy DeVoat, who's a partner at Loeb & Loeb, Professor Carolyn Shapiro from Chicago Kent College of Law, and Professor Ronald Rotunda from Chapman University School of Law. Thank you all for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
So this is sort of our Super Bowl for legal geeks, right? I mean, you only get the chance to talk about Supreme Court nominees every few years, and we've got Judge Gorsuch. So, Professor Rotunda, we've got some background on his writings. A lot of us haven't, you know, dived deep into a lot of his decisions, but one that got a lot of attention was a book that he wrote on assisted suicide. Lots of folks are sort of predicting how he will rule on the abortion issue based on what he wrote about assisted suicide. Do you think that's an accurate predictor?
No. I mean, I guess we'll never know for sure. But first of all, a lot of judges write books and articles, and when the actual case comes before them, they sometimes disagree with themselves. This happened years ago with Justice Roberts, not the chief, but another one named Justice Jackson, who wrote an opinion as Attorney General, and he said, you know, now that I'm Supreme Court Justice, I got a different view of things. So I don't think we'd all like to know the future, and all we can know about the future is it's not very knowable.
Professor Shapiro, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has already come out against Judge Gorsuch, not surprisingly. He's talked about tying up the nomination. There's been some speculation that he'll filibuster. By all accounts, Judge Gorsuch, while people might not necessarily agree with his philosophy, seems to be incredibly well qualified. He sailed through his nomination to the federal bench 10 years ago. There wasn't even a vote. So the question to you is, do you think we'll see a fight in the Senate over his nomination? Do you think politics will play into it? Or do you think he'll, while people might disagree with him, do you think he'll get the 60 votes necessary?
Well, I do think we'll see a fight. And I think that has as much to do with what happened to Judge Garland as anything to do with Judge Gorsuch's own qualifications. The Democrats, I think, are still very angry that Judge Garland was denied even a hearing in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Judge Garland, of course, was just President Obama's nominee to replace Justice Scalia. So I think there are many Democrats who feel that this is actually an illegitimate nomination, not in the sense of being illegal, but that in the sense that the Senate Republicans really violated a lot of very longstanding norms when they refused to even consider Judge Garland. So for that reason alone, I think there's likely to be a fight. In terms of whether there's likely to be a fight on that's related to Judge Gorsuch's opinions or his views, I think we'll have to wait and see more what comes out at the hearing. A lot of Democrats are saying that they have concerns, but they're waiting to learn more. I think Senator Schumer has essentially indicated that. But the most important thing, frankly, is going to be what he has to say about the independence of the judiciary in light of President Trump's recent attacks on the judge in Washington State.
Oh, yeah, that I can predict. He'll say the judiciary is independent.
Well, I think
of course he will. And by the way, it's not above presidents. I mean, other presidents have attacked the judiciary as well. I mean, Clinton went after a district judge in New York, a federal district judge, who afterwards changed his opinion on admitting evidence. So that's just the kind of world we live in, and it's a little bit like in Casablanca to be shocked that there's gambling going on in an establishment. This stuff has been going on for years.
Andy, what is your thoughts on Gorsuch being actually making it to be nominated and approved as a Supreme Court? Or should President Trump get a backup nomination in line?
Well, two things. One, no, I don't think he should get a backup nomination in line. Second, I think both professors' good points, albeit from different perspectives, is that one thing that's going to be interesting about the hearings, I think, is that when they do get past some of the hard feelings over Judge Garland, which I understand, I think it will be interesting given in light of President Trump's recent actions, a lot of questioning about executive authority. And I think that it happens a number of times with other Supreme Court justices who are now there. They've been asked questions about issues that the court may have to face. And so what you'll see that you've seen in other hearings is that there may be questions about issues where Judge Gorsuch walks a line where he wants to seem transparent, to seem helpful, to seem ready to answer their questions, but in the same vein, not weighing in on issues that he thinks it's likely he may see when he, you know, real life tangible disputes that he may see when he's a justice. So if he's confirmed. So I think that'll be an interesting, there'll be a lot of statements from senators about Judge Garland, and then I think a lot of questioning about executive authority. You know, in terms of Judge Gorsuch, I mean, you know, I think on the last, I was lucky enough to be on the panel with these professors last time. I think we talked about the list, and I think, you know, I would say Judge Gorsuch, of the 20 people on that list that President Trump put out, I think he has to be near the top in terms of qualifications for the job. There's no doubt. I think that's reason why you see people like Neil Keitel, who was the acting Solicitor General for President Obama. I know a personal friend, Jeff Lampkin, who's a friend of his. Those are two of the nation's best Supreme Court advocates. You know, both have said the same things, that they may disagree personally with his views, but that I think one of their quotes was, save your battleships, you know, for the next seat and for the next fight, because this is a really well-qualified guy that, you know, we may disagree with.
So his qualifications are unassailable. I think most people agree with that. I think one interesting point to talk about, and I'd like your opinions on this, is to what degree can you really predict what a nominee is going to do once they're on the bench? And, you know, maybe the folly of that. For example, we've seen, you know, Harry Blackmun was nominated by Nixon. Blackmun went on to be one of the most liberal justices in Supreme Court history. David Souter, who was a very, you know, unknown pick at the time that George Bush made him, turned out to be an incredible disappointment to Republicans because of how he ruled on the bench. So is it possible to predict how Judge Gorsuch will rule once he is elevated to the highest court in the land based on his prior rulings? Professor Shapiro, why don't you address that if you can?
Well, I mean, it's always hard to predict completely, because once a person is on the Supreme Court, they have more freedom than they do as an appellate court judge. But I think he has a pretty strong record in terms of his writings, at least in certain areas. For example, with respect to freedom of religion and the balance between freedom of religion and free exercise and women's right to contraceptive coverage, for example, he wrote a concurring opinion in the Hobby Lobby case in which which he was extremely deferential to the claims of the owners of Hobby Lobby. So we know it's unlikely that something like that he will change his mind about once he gets to the Supreme Court. Now, there are some areas we don't know as much about. We don't know, for example, even if he's uncomfortable with, say, abortion and would have not voted for Roe in the first place, we don't have as much information about whether he would, in fact, vote to overrule it. The senators will undoubtedly try to get him to reveal that in the hearing, and he probably won't go along with that.
Professor Rotunda, you're a historian on these issues. I'm always curious what exactly is discussed when the nominee goes up on the Hill and has these meetings. You know, they're great.
The private meetings?
Yeah, well, these private, I mean, you know, we see the pictures of them sitting in the office and talking to the senators. But, you know, does a senator flat out ask a Judge Gorsuch, what will you do with Roe v. Wade, or is it more cursory? What exactly, I mean, to the extent that any of us knows, we're not senators, but what's that meeting look like?
We don't know, because we're not flies on the wall. These if he actually answers questions like that, I would be surprised and shocked. People don't realize that this tradition of having private meetings with the senators only goes back several decades. Sandra Day O'Connor might have been the first one, but she was one of the first where they actually did this. In fact, if you go back to the era of Brandeis, when he was confirmed, he never even testified. The custom was for the nominee to travel to Washington, D.C., and sit in a hotel room, and occasionally they sent him a telegram from the hearing that they wanted a question asked, and he might answer it. When it was a nominee who was in the Senate, the custom was to have no hearing at all. They would just confirm. So it's what we think of as long traditions is they're not long at all. As the court has become more political, it was a big issue in the last presidential campaign. That's one of the big issues of Trump was vote for me because I'll nominate somebody from this list, or vote for Hillary and you'll get somebody like Garland but younger. And that was one of the issues that the exit polls showed animated, I think, about 30% of the voters in how they voted. One thing we know for sure is that if he lives his expected lifespan, he's going to be on the court 20 or 30 years, and we don't know what the big legal issues are 10 years from now, much less what's the liberal or conservative answer to them. Abortion wasn't an issue when Blackmun was appointed to the court. And while we think of Blackmun as liberal, that's only because liberals have decided abortion is a very liberal thing. On other things, like the death penalty, he was very conservative. He was constantly voting to uphold the death penalty until the very end of his career, when it didn't matter very much. So it's nice to engage in these predictions, though they tend to be evidence of our fallibility. What we would like is somebody who's got an open mind and will listen to arguments on both sides. And I have been impressed the number of people on both sides of the aisle that say he's that kind of person.
This question's for everyone on the panel, but there's been some rumors, a lot of news articles, that Justice Kennedy might retire. There was some quote that if a Republican had been won the election, then he might retire. Can you guys give us what your opinion is on whether or not Justice Kennedy retires during Trump's presidency?
I think it's impossible to know. I think he very much enjoys the role of the swing justice. And I don't see him being in a big hurry to retire. It probably will depend in part on whether he has any health concerns, which I know of none. But, he's probably quite private about that. So I have no idea.
Well, let's address it from this angle before we hear from Andy. Professor Shapiro, you're a former clerk for Justice Stephen Breyer of the Supreme Court. Andy, mm-hmm. You're a former clerk for Chief Justice William Rehnquist of the Supreme Court. If he makes it to the Supreme Court, Judge Gorsuch would be the only first ever former clerk to work alongside the justice that he worked with. That would be Justice Kennedy. So, number one, how would that be if you worked alongside your justice that you worked for? Would that be strange? And number two, to Jason's question, do you think that that this would make Justice Kennedy more likely to step down sooner because he feels comfortable that someone that he trained is now on the bench with him? Let's have both Professor Shapiro and Andy address that.
Well, I think the hardest thing would be getting used to calling Justice Breyer by his first name, which is how the justices address each other. It would be quite an adjustment. I suspect that I'm sure they've maintained a relationship over the years, and that there's a lot of mutual respect there. I'm kind of skeptical about the idea that this will tip the scales for Justice Kennedy in terms of his retirement.
Andy, last point goes to you.
Sure. So, I agree. It would be weird. Luckily, I wouldn't have to call him by his first name because everyone called Chief Justice Rehnquist just Chief. So, that'd be a little easier. But I agree it would be gratifying and strange. But the Chief ran a tight ship, and I'm sure it would be, we've got a schedule to keep and opinions to write. So, let's get to it, Andy.
Well, now that this trend is established, though, I think there's a good chance that we're talking to one of the next justices right here. Now, you know, Justice Shapiro, Justice DeVote.
Don't hold
your second point. Yeah. I don't think so either. I know that there's been a lot of speculation by, and I respect everyone's trying to make a living, speculation about what that means for Justice Kennedy. I just don't think it, in my opinion, it enters into his calculus. I think his health, his ability to do the job, and those types of things weigh more heavily. I mean, as someone has said, if it's Justice Gorsuch, onto the court is in some ways is a little bit back to the status quo, as it were, before the untimely and unfortunate passing of Justice Scalia.
Andy DeVote, Professor Ronald Rotunda, Professor Carolyn Shapiro, thank you for spending time with us on WGN.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having us.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Legal Face-Off on WGN at WGNradio.com. We move along here. We talk about the Illinois Workers' Compensation Reform, and to do that, we're bringing David Manchetti, who's a partner at Cullen, Haskins, Nicholson, and Manchetti. Jay Shattuck, Executive Director of the Illinois Chamber of Commerce's Employment Law Council, and Mark Densler, who's the VP and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, all-star panel of Illinois workers' comp professionals. We want to dive right in. Jay, let's start with you. Why reform and why now?
Well, we've had some issues with being able to compete for good jobs in the manufacturing, construction, industries and others, technology that have good paying jobs with good benefits, and workers' compensation tends to be one of the factors that is a detriment to Illinois being able to retain and attract new jobs.
Hey, Dave, can you tell us what is coming up inside this legislation, maybe two or three of the highlights of the bill?
So Senate Bill 12 has been filed by Republican leader Christine Redonio, and some of the changes included in that bill involve further reductions in the medical fee schedule that are the reimbursement rates that apply to doctors and hospitals that treat injured workers. And then there are other benefit reductions that affect injured workers directly.
And one of the components in here, I guess we'll shoot this to Mark, calls for a cap on the physical therapy visits. I read one portion they're going to max them out at 24. Can you give us a background where that came from and why you think that's important?
Well, I think Jay kind of touched on it, but the importance overall is Illinois has the eighth highest cost of workers' compensation in the United States, and it makes us an outlier in terms of manufacturing. We've lost about 300,000 jobs since the year 2000, while other states have gained. And so workers' compensation is extremely high cost, so there are a number of things on the table. One of those that I'm not sure makes the final pay would be capping the number of visits to PT, OT, and chiropractors. I think it creates more of a floor, and so I'm not sure it makes the final package. But at the end of the day, we're just trying to reduce costs while still ensuring that workers have access to good health care.
Let's have all you weigh in on this question, going back to why we're here and why now. We had reform in 2011, most recently in Illinois, pretty substantial reform package in which AMA ratings were introduced. That is the system whereby a doctor will apportion a rating for a body part. That was introduced. A utilization review, which is basically peer review, allows one doctor to look at another doctor's recommendation. It reduced the overall fee schedule. So all those changes were made as recently as 2011. Jay, why do we need to pick up reform again if we recently did it in 2011?
At 2011 certainly was a move in the right direction. I don't think anybody denies that. But we were at third highest in cost back in 2011 in terms of on average cost for the country, not being able to really compete with other states. So going from 2011, we're tied at eighth highest, and I think we're looking for something much, much better than that. So again, that we're able to attract those good paying jobs with great benefits in especially those key industries that I mentioned earlier. And so 2017, there's no reason why we should be, as many other states are looking to attract businesses through more competitive workers' compensation costs, and I think Illinois needs to get with the program.
Dave Menchetti, like Jason Whiteside, you represent injured workers before the Illinois workers' compensation system. I take it you disagree with Jay that additional reforms are necessary.
Yes, I disagree. And the reason that I disagree is because since 2011, it's been shown that workers' compensation costs have come down for Illinois employers. For example, the rates that apply to insurance premiums have gone down by 32%. The loss costs to insurance companies that insure these kinds of liabilities have gone down by more than 25%. Regarding that eighth ranking that has been talked about, that comes from a study that tries to compare states to states, but even the authors of that study say that it shouldn't be used in that way. The authors have said things like, this isn't a report card, the study is not an overall evaluation of states' workers' compensation systems, that these types of rankings have major limitations for interstate comparison. So really what those rankings show is that other states are engaged in this race to the bottom to reduce benefits to injured workers as much as possible, and I don't think Illinois should engage in that race to the bottom.
And Dave, you and I have had conversations about NCCI and a study that was done. What was that again? It was after, I think it was a four-year study after 2011, after the reforms were put into place. And what were some of the conclusions that came about through that NCCI study?
So NCCI is the organization that sets the rates for most of the workers' compensation insurers in Illinois. And every year, NCCI comes up with a rate recommendation. If you add up all of the rate reduction recommendations that NCCI has made since 2011, it's over a 32% reduction, which, as far as I can tell, is the largest reduction for that same period of time of any state in the United States. And NCCI also calculates something called loss costs, which is what insurers pay out. And they say that since 2011, loss costs have come down by 25%. I don't know that there's any other business expense that an employer has that has come down by 25 to 30% since 2011.
Mark, again, Mark Denzer, Illinois Manufacturers Association, you disagree. You feel that these studies do have some merits, or do you not? How do you feel about the data that Dave has referenced?
Well, the studies certainly have merit. They show what the cost is per $100 of payroll, and we're about 25, 26% higher than the average state. And Dave talks about the 25% reduction in cost loss. And, you know, part of that is we've lost good, high-paying manufacturing jobs. And these are ones that generally, when there's an accident in the workforce or the workplace, generally manufacturing employees have worse accidents than maybe the service sector or the retail sector. And so a lot of this has been the loss of good manufacturing and construction jobs because we're just simply not competitive here. I talked to a company the other day in central Illinois. The difference between them staying here and leaving was a $4 million annual work comp cost. And so as we see these jobs leave the state and head to greener pastures, that's not a good thing for the state of Illinois, while other states are gaining tens of thousands of jobs. So we certainly need more reforms to make Illinois more competitive.
All right, this question's for all three of you. Where's this bill at right now, and what's the likelihood that it's going to be passed in its current form or will it be chopped up? I know it's a compound question, but anyone can jump in.
Well, this is Mark. So it's part of a 13-bill package, and keep in mind they're looking to generate additional revenue, make some budget cuts, and then do some reforms on pensions and things like workers' compensation. So each of these on their own are a very heavy lift, and when you put 12 or 13 things together, just makes it all that more difficult. But we applaud Senate President Kolich and Leader Redonio for trying to do something to get a resolution to the budget impasse. And, you know, it's, again, a very difficult lift, a lot of moving parts, but our discussions are continuing as we speak.
Jay, chances of this getting signed by the governor in February of 2017?
Oh, I would say that's probably a long shot. As Mark has said, there's quite a few moving pieces, and I think that it will all have to be tied in with budget changes, and I think that that's still doable during the spring session, and I would be hopeful that it would get done by the 1st of June.
Let's talk about causation for a second, because that is one of the most important issues in the minds of many Illinois employers. It's something that certainly my clients, when they talk about complaints that they have about our system, reference the fact that, you know, they perceive causation as a very liberal standard. All you need to prove as a injured worker is that work might or could have caused or aggravated your condition. Yet causation, even though a lot of employers want it to be addressed, is not in the four corners of Senate Bill 12. Jay, why is that?
Well, again, there are interest groups that are, you know, lobbying vigorously against any kind of workers' compensation reform and causation, I think, based on some of the pushback we're getting from organized labor and those representing injured workers in terms of attorneys. They're making a serious push. There's nothing that they see in terms of benefits from changing the causation standard from their perspective. And what we've seen across the country, again, is a movement towards something that is what we would consider a higher standard than what we have here in Illinois, something that's either primary cause or substantial factor or prevailing factor, so that you have the workplace being demonstrated as something more than just a cause of the injury or illness.
Dave, you disagree that causation should be addressed?
Yes, I disagree.
Why is that?
Well, because it's already addressed under current law in a fashion that requires an injured worker to prove by a preponderance of the credible medical evidence, including sometimes very complex medical testimony, that there's a causal connection between his injury and the condition of disability. So there's already a law on this point. There's already an opportunity for employers to defend cases based on this causation argument, and oftentimes employers win on that argument in the current environment of the Workers' Compensation Commission. So, no, there's no reason to change this. In fact, if it is changed, it could cause some short-term costs, because as people try to figure out what the new causation standard means, that will mean additional litigation, and of course with the litigation there comes costs.
Dave, do you see anything in this bill that would benefit, we're both petitioners' attorneys, do you see anything that would benefit petitioners out of this bill?
There is some provision regarding penalties for non-authorization of medical treatment, which could be a benefit to injured workers. But what's lacking from this bill and this proposal, which would really benefit injured workers and employers alike, is some insurance oversight. There's no insurance premium oversight in this bill to ensure that whatever reductions are made are actually passed on to Illinois employers in the form of reduced insurance premiums.
If we could get a one-word answer in the 30 seconds or so we've got left on Legal Face-Off, we'd like each of you to tell us one thing that you would want changed about Illinois workers' compensation if you had that power.
We'll only start, one word? Only, just one word?
It could be one or several, but just tell us what you'd like to see changed. If you can only enact one change, what would it be? Jay Shattuck.
Improve the causation standard.
Mark Densler?
Improve the causation standard would be first.
Do we have a consensus, Dave Benchetti? I assume not.
I'll be the dissenting voice. Improve workplace safety. That avoids injuries to begin with.
Jason Whiteside?
I don't have one. I think one right now, I don't really have one. I mean, there's a whole litany as a practitioner that I think are there's a lot that I'd like to see changed.
I'll tell you,
sometimes we have trouble just getting a decision from an arbitrator these days.
Yeah,
so
that would
be great.
To that point, I would actually enact a lot more practical changes with regards to everyday work. You know,
yeah, the
for
system
example,
as it's
discovery
set up right now is just antiquated. I mean,
right.
It doesn't.
There's no discovery. There's no ability for respondents to pursue penalties like there is for petitioners. So
it's not like they're awarding penalties a lot lately, anyway. So. But, yeah, no, I think the practical procedural aspects of the commission can be streamlined a lot better than they are right now.
Agree.
Great panel. I love when we play the one-word game. We never get close to one
word.
You're
asking a bunch of attorneys to use one word. It's not going to happen.
Dave Menchetti, Jay Shattuck, and Mark Densler, thank you all so much for joining us here on WGN.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
Rounding out the guest portion of our show, news by the President, Donald Trump. He has threatened to send in the feds if the Chicago carnage isn't fixed. And to talk about it, we bring in Horace Cooper, who is the adjunct fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research. He's also the co-chairman of the Project 21 National Advisory Board and a fellow with Constituting America. And he joins us now on WGN. Good morning.
Hey, great. Thank you for having me on the program.
Thanks for joining us. So Trump has been obviously a little bit in the news. I'm not sure if we've all heard his tweets, but
over the last 2 weeks alone,
little busy since he took the oath of office. And one of the things he's tweeted about has been Chicago, and he threatened to, in his words, send in the feds if Chicago carnage isn't fixed. What did he mean by that? And well, let's start with there. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, there's been quite a big discussion here in Washington, D.C., the area where I reside, as to what kind of policy prescription makes the most sense. And part of that has been an issue of what role could the Department of Justice play in fixing or addressing or helping to alleviate the Chicago death and shooting crisis that's taking place. And largely, I think, he was responding to that by saying that some of those persuasive arguments he has found some salience and would be open to implementing.
Well, you've said it a lot more articulately than he did. I mean, I think I don't know if he put in the thought behind what that means. I mean, there's been a lot of confusion, and he's since, you know, maybe clarified it. There's been some talk by Mayor Emanuel what that should mean. But is it wise for the President of the United States to simply say we're going to send in the feds to Chicago without explaining what he means by that?
Well, I guess it depends on who your target audience is. If your grandmother raising three kids that children of yours are either incarcerated or no longer in the picture, and you're worried about what's going to happen in terms of their ability to continue to get an education and live safely, the idea that something is likely to happen that's going to make that a little easier on you would probably be quite welcome. If, on the other hand, you operate in some of the wonk headquarters like I do, you're very concerned about what those specific prescriptions might actually look like. And, you know, sometimes we'd prefer it be us that gets to make those announcements. But at the end of the day, it really does depend on who is asking the question, are you bothered? I think a lot of people who felt like they've lived too long in this mist, in the midst of misery, are ready for some action.
Horace, do you think it's any coincidence that there are 20 more ATF agents headed to Chicago this week or in the near future? This news was just released over the weekend.
No, absolutely I don't. The issue here is what kind of coordination is there going to be? There are probably as many government agencies here in Washington, D.C., trying to undermine the administration as there are government agencies trying to figure out how they can quickly implement. So it would help to get an attorney general confirmed so that some direction can be provided. But absolutely, I would say that there are actions that have been sort of sitting on the table waiting for implementation, and even just seeing the tweet causes midline managers to say, okay, we're ready to start moving in this direction.
Horace, according to one study, Northern Illinois ranked 90 out of 90 in prosecutions of federal weapons crimes under the Obama administration. So might federalizing gun prosecutions in Chicago help make the scourge of crime and gun violence in our city better. Maybe that's what Trump was
That is exactly
to.
What happened in Richmond, Virginia, when in the late 1980s, early 1990s, there was a huge gun misuse abuse problem taking place. And the Eastern District of Virginia, a U.S. attorney, highlighted and made a priority out of prosecuting those individuals who has, as the Chicago Tribune reported a couple years back, overwhelmingly we see the same people, many of them have convictions for prior misuse of firearms, and whose now presence would in fact constitute a lawful basis for the federal government to interject itself into. So absolutely, that would be a great first step to look at. Coordination on gang interdiction. There's nearly a $27 billion fund set aside by the Department of Justice for various kinds of law enforcement activity that communities can apply for, seek out, and be able to have access to so that they can be more effective in this regard. So you could, in fact, get the feds to use the DEA and the FBI on the gang front. There are a number of fairly, we might call them shovel-ready, if we were talking about infrastructure, activities that could be undertaken that would have a fairly immediate effect on making the cost of doing crime in Chicago substantially higher.
Okay, Horace, if you have these 20 agents coming to Chicago, right, they're all going to be transferred here permanently. How do they actually interact with the Chicago Police Department, with the mayor? Like, who has to step up and say, this is what the implementation is going to be, and this is how we're going to fix the gun violence homicide rate in the city of Chicago?
So when the Secret Service and the FBI show up after a bank robbery, they simply flash their badges. Sometimes they have to go through the problem of actually bringing a letter from their supervisor saying, this is now our issue and we're taking it over. The fact of the matter is a Federalist insertion is a priority that the other local jurisdictions, both the county and the state, must yield to. And so it's not a question of will there be some ability of the local communities to coordinate. It's will they be required to. Under present law, no executive order needed, no shift in direction needed. The practice is, just as they can come in and federalize a bank robbery investigation, they could also do similar things with this serial criminal misuse and abuse of firearms in possession by felons.
Doesn't that require a change in law, though? I mean, how then do you separate what is appropriate for the feds versus what should be handled by local prosecutors?
If the Cook County comes across a ID cooking house, a place where phony identification cards are created, and it turns out that there's also a counterfeiting machine taking place, no one has to have a special law created for the feds to come in and say, hold on, this is our baby, we're going to come in and intervene here. And they could do the very same thing for drug trafficking. They could do the very same thing for serial abuse and possession by felons who have already been convicted on a prior basis. All that it means is, and in New York City, they had what they called Federal Day. All that happens is the arrests that occur, quote, on Federal Day, everybody is actually subject to federal prosecution. So instead of you're going to be released on your own recognizance, or you know that the maximum amount of time that the judge is going to give you is a year and a half, and the maximum amount of time you'll actually serve out of that is probably the amount of time that you sat in jail waiting for trial, it turns into a your time doesn't start until you go to the federal penitentiary, and that's going to be 5 years minimum. That changes the calculus. As I say, the issue here for significant reduction in crime is to raise the cost of doing the crime in the jurisdiction where you're exercising this new interest.
That's Horace Cooper out of Washington. Great stuff on the Chicago Carnage. Thank you for joining us on Legal Faceoff. Close up the show with the Legal Grab Bag, Legal Face-Off on WGN with Rich, Jason. My name is Sam. We've got seven topics today, but before we get started, Super Bowl 51 last night. It was 28-3 Falcons, and then the Falcons gave up that lead.
Unbelievable.
And they give up 31 unanswered points.
Much as I hate the Patriots, you gotta hand this.
It was an amazing comeback. Unbelievable. Third quarter, it looked like it was over, but I don't know, Tom Brady.
I still have that image of Brady like at halftime with his head in his hands, and he looked just, you know, I think he was acting because he wanted us all to. He was rope-a-doping.
Yeah, he's like an evil genius. Yeah. He's like, ha ha ha.
It's unbelievable.
I have to fall on the sword. I had the under 59. It's 28-3. So when they tied it and made it 28-28, I knew I couldn't win.
Yeah.
And then, of course, instead of kicking a field goal, they score a touchdown.
I mean, fresh that no one's really talked about the collapse of the Falcons. Everyone's crediting. I mean, when you look at it, like, it's one of the greatest collapses of all time.
Well, so I mean, someone said it best. This isn't my quote, but they said the Falcons were playing not to lose and the Patriots were playing to win. And so you kind of...
I don't know. The first half, they were playing pretty aggressive. I thought the Falcons were playing aggressively. But then, yeah, second half...
But they didn't
half,
score
right.
a single point yeah, like second, the third or fourth quarter. So, I don't know.
It was 28-9 with 10 minutes left.
I mean, I'm a victim of... I grew up watching the Houston Oilers and loving that team. So I was a victim of the greatest comeback in... playoff history. The Buffalo Bills, Frank Reich led them to like a 30-point comeback against the Oilers back in the 90s, but this is the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history.
Yeah.
So we move from football to political football.
To football.
The Bears are battling the players' union over, ooh, look at this, workers' compensation.
Well, it all comes full circle. Yeah, we talked earlier about the workers' comp reform with our guests. One of the things in Senate Bill 12, one of the proposed changes is to basically reduce the benefits for athletes who are filing workers' compensation claims in Illinois. Currently, you get to receive benefits for what's called wage differential, which basically means, you know, if you can't earn as much after the injury as you earned before. Right now, the law is that you get to get paid until you're 67. There's some logic to that if you're, you know, an average worker and you might have a work life until 65 or 70. But the NFL and the Bears specifically are petitioning the legislature to lower that number to 35, arguing that the average lifespan of a player is certainly not until 67, but it's more like mid-30s. The average lifespan is only a couple of years, so that if you're injured, you shouldn't be able to get benefits until 67.
Well, and the Bears sit in an interesting position. I mean, they're in the state of Illinois, which has, you know, out of all the states surrounding the area, they have pretty favorable work comp laws for the injured worker. So these guys that are on the practice squad and get injured can, you know, recover wage differential for the rest of, well, until age 67 now. But so there are players that, you know, are no longer on the team but suffered an injury then that, you know, were able to claim the work comp on it. So
yeah, I mean, the players' union predictably has come out very strongly against this reform. Damori Smith, who's the head of the NFLPA, has said that this is just a greedy move by the owners of the Bears, who have plenty of money, and they should, you know, allow players, not the superstars, but generally it's lesser known players,
yeah, who have
to receive
one
benefits.
And a half year right. shelf life in the NFL.
Yeah.
Let's stick with football. Giants defensive end Jason Pierre-Paul blew off one of his fingers on the 4th of July in 2015. ESPN took that stuff and made it public, and now they are settling the lawsuit with the Giants D-star.
Yeah, Jason Pierre-Paul, like Sam had said, blew off a finger or two in a 4th of July incident. While he was in the hospital, apparently an ESPN football reporter, Adam Schefter, who everyone knows, revealed that Pierre-Paul had his right index finger amputated. And he actually tweeted it and then showed a screenshot of Pierre-Paul's medical chart. Well, everyone knows, I mean, what HIPAA is, but there's certain protections that are in place for medical information. So Jason Pierre-Paul filed suit saying that Schefter improperly obtained the medical records and then selfishly displayed them to 4 million Twitter followers. So the suit went up. There was a couple motions that were filed, and eventually they ended up settling. The privacy issue is what's really at stake here that Jason Pierre-Paul had argued in the briefs, though, that, you know, his medical records and charts were not to be made available to Adam Schefter. Somehow he was able to get them, so that's what he had filed.
Have you seen the pictures? I'm sure you've seen him, Sam, right?
I've seen him try and put a glove on.
Yeah.
Like when he puts his glove on now to go play,
well,
there's something missing.
Yeah. The pictures of his hand right after the incident are incredibly gruesome.
It looks like hamburger meat on top of
pretty
his
much,
big old palm.
Yeah. Lesson here, takeaway, folks.
Have someone else light off the fireworks.
Hire someone, as Jason Whiteside does. Hire a team of people.
Get that one idiot from your neighborhood to light those
this
off.
This shouldn't hurt too much.
Let's move from blown off fingers to pacemakers. A man in Middletown, Ohio has been charged with aggravated arson and insurance fraud after data on his pacemaker was inconsistent with claims about his physical activity when his house burned down.
Yeah, Ross Compton said his house lit up on fire, so he packed a bag, broke a window with his cane, and then tossed his belongings outside. The only problem is the police were able to track down the data on his pacemaker and send it to a cardiologist who reviewed the data and said that it's highly improbable a person with Compton's medical condition would be able to pack the bag in such a short amount of time, break the window, and throw out his goods. The other thing was that they found multiple points of origin for the fire, and the gasoline was found on Compton's shoes and clothing. So he was just arrested and charged with arson. So it'll be interesting to see if this is allowed into evidence at his trial or not. It has to be a first impression to use a heart rate monitor or the pacemaker to convict someone.
Let's talk about our guy, Peter Francis Geraci. It's always fun to talk dog condo lawsuits.
You know, file this under the rich people problem segment of the grab bag because... I mean, only in America. So Peter Francis Geraci is a well-known bankruptcy lawyer here in Chicago. For many years, we've all seen his bankruptcy infotapes on late-night television. Well, his wife is named Holly Geraci, and she has filed a lawsuit against her condo association in River North, one of the most expensive parts of the country. And I think we talked about this on a prior show. They set the record for the most expensive condo purchase in the United States.
Yeah, they had that bid against the, who was it, the Saudi prince or whatever?
Right.
They were outbidding him.
So she filed suit in federal court alleging that she was being discriminated against and that the association was violating the Fair Housing Act and the Illinois Human Rights Act by making her share a condo or the condo elevator with dogs. Apparently, the condo association allows dogs in the elevator, and she alleges in this federal suit that she was attacked by a German shepherd when she was a child and has a fear of large dogs. She claims post-traumatic stress disorder from this attack, and not only is the condo association discriminating against her with this condition by allowing dogs, they're also encouraging residents to mock her and insult her. So the condo association filed a motion for summary judgment, and last week a federal judge ruled that the lawsuit could proceed. So very important legal news here in Illinois.
Buy lots more of those bankruptcy info tapes.
Yeah. Again, rich people problems.
Yeah.
These stories keep getting better and better today. An IRS lawyer has been charged in an alleged meth conspiracy.
Wasn't the last one meth also? I think there's some meth involved in the pacemaker story, wasn't there?
No, I don't think so. Was there?
There's usually meth involved.
Meth.
There's always meth involved in anyone that makes the legal news. A professor at Georgetown University, Jack Vitayanin, was charged with conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine. Jack was a professor, an adjunct professor at Georgetown, and a co-instructor of the course Tax Lawyer and Professional Responsibility in Federal Tax Practice. He was investigated after agents seized a FedEx package that contained methamphetamines in it. So, it's always ironic when a law school professor is convicted or accused or arrested of such a deplorable crime.
Well, the best part was the press release. The press release said that the lawyer broke bad and supplemented his income by selling distribution quantities of methamphetamine.
It's always great to abuse the English language in order to promote a TV show.
Well, yeah, reference everyone's favorite meth TV show.
The U.S. government's hysterical.
They are. They're funny.
Five down, two to go. There is a Ponzi scheme, and I love a good Ponzi scheme. The curtain has fallen on an alleged $81 million Ponzi scheme for Hamilton tickets.
Yeah, we've all been aware of people waiting for hours, spending thousands of dollars for Hamilton tickets. A pair of New Yorkers decided to profit on this. They drummed up a, according to the SEC allegations, they drummed up a Hamilton pyramid scheme that would ended up defrauding more than 100 investors of at least $81 million. Basically, according to the SEC lawsuit that was filed recently, these two individuals would approach investors seeking to pull money, buy tickets to Hamilton, an Adele concert, and other highly in-demand shows, and then resell them for a profit. They came up with company names like Advance Entertainment. They offered contracts for lucrative repayment of the funds, 10% profit. They raised $81 million from 125 investors across 13 states. And at least $51 million of the investor funds, according to the lawsuit filed in the Southern District of New York, were diverted to perpetuate a Ponzi scheme just to enrich themselves. They claim they had an agreement with Hamilton, one of the producers, for a batch of 35,000 tickets. So, you know, leave it to...
I wonder what the return was, like the sales pitch was. It was probably just like Bernie Madoff, right? I'm going to get you 40% return on your money. Unheard of.
You couldn't pay me to go see Hamilton, for the record. Did you guys go? Have you seen it yet?
Yeah, I have.
I have not.
Was it worth it?
My daughter's obsessed.
I thought it was really good.
You saw it, really?
Yeah.
With, on your own, or just a man at the theater singing along to...
It was right after the opera. Saw a couple, yeah.
Yeah, my daughter... my daughter, who's 11, is literally obsessed with it, has been for like, you know, since
I find
started.
The more junior high and high school girls are obsessed with Hamilton.
It really
is. It's not like a... I mean, it's a historical musical, and it's really pretty accurate. It's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously hugely popular. I haven't seen it. My daughter saw it once. She wants to see it again. So thankfully, we didn't buy tickets from these two characters in New York.
Yeah, or invest in the Ponzi scheme.
Right.
Last but certainly not least, Bethany Frankel's ex-husband was arrested in New York Friday. A representative for the NYPD confirmed this. She was married to Hoppy, who I don't know who Hoppy is. But he faces misdemeanor charges of stalking and harassment. He has pleaded not guilty.
Yeah, Jason Hoppy.
Jason
Hoppy. It's not some bunny, like bunny character or something. He sent 160 texts or emails to her that caused her to fear for her safety. They began allegedly back in August when she received a text that said, "Despite your games, I'll never let you do to me what your mother did to your father. I'll never go away." They led to a cease and desist letter. Apparently, according to the allegation, or according to the complaint, I should say, he approached her and her boyfriend at a location and said, "Okay, I see. This is how you want to do this. Okay, you can play your game. It doesn't matter. You can get 10 lawyers. There's nothing you can do to stop me. You'll be sorry. You've been warned. I can't help it. She's pure evil. You've been warned. Don't say I didn't warn you." By the way, sounds like a Sam Panyanovich transcript from your last couple of dates. But anyway, So obviously, the authorities took this seriously, and they've gone ahead and arrested Mr. Hoppy.
So it wasn't just a text about like what's going on with the child and custody. It sounds a little bit more intense than that.
I think we should just call him Hoppy.
Hoppy.
That should be. That's a new trend.
Just one name, not two.
This is unbelievable. That is a lot. 160 texts in all.
Yeah, this is after, by the way, they reached a settlement over custody of their child, which was a big deal. I think the divorce proceedings were still going on when this all allegedly occurred.
They had all that skinny margarita money to split up.
Absolutely.
Great show. Thanks to all of our guests. Thanks to Craig Collins. For anything you may have missed, WGMRadio.com. For Rich, Jason, I am Sam. We will talk to you in 2 weeks on Legal Face-Off.
Tune in to... You've binge challenged Craig Collins.
I thought you were going to say Bill and Wendy.
Nah.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
Craig's podcast.
Yes. We'll see you in 2 weeks.